Temenair drew his lungs full, thought of Lawrence, and roared out his challenge. He kept roaring a long time. The Chevaliers jerked up in their clearing at once, their wings opening even before their eyes had, and began roaring furious answer, their heads twisting this way and that as they searched the sky for him. Men came racing from the tents about them. Temeraire saw a captain with flashes of gold on his shoulder being put up. They sprang into the air, half-crewed, men leaping for the harness from the ground as they rose.
"Je suis là!"
Temeraire called out, propelling himself with great thrusts backwards away from the camp, and roared again.
"Me voilà!"
They wheeled mid-air and came barreling straight towards him, teeth bared, and he hovered and waited, and then dropped himself straight out of the way, his wings folded close and tight while they shot by, white flashes of rifle fire sparking along their backs. And behind them, Gentius came soaring gracefully down over the camp on his widespread, enormous wings, and spat acid over 10 cannon in a row. Bells of alarum were clanging madly now, torches lit, men rushing out to form into rows as the handful of horses screamed and struggled against their handlers. Temeraire could not help a wild, surging sensation of excitement, almost overpowering, as Requiescat and Ballista and Majestatis came thundering down through the camp, claws and tails dragging through tents and pickets and fires all alike, scattering them, and the red banners glowing in the fires that bloomed at once all over. He dived down and joined their long, straight row, stretching his ruff wide. They tore across the full length of the camp without a pause and whipped back up aloft, trailing canvas and rope and anything else they had snagged upon their claws. Once they had gone high enough again they could not be shot, they pulled it all off and let it drop down upon the camp. Persaetia had suggested the notion, as they had no bombs.
"Especially if you can get some tents pulled up and drop them on the pepper guns," she had said,
and it answered remarkably well. Most of the tents bundled up as they dropped, but one luckily unfurled and floated down in a heap atop a company of infantry trying to aim the long-barrelled pepper guns, the bayonets poking out of it and making them only worse entangled.
"Oh," Temeraire said exultantly, "oh, it is working! Persaetia, look!"
But she was nowhere to be seen, and he could not spend time finding her. The Chevaliers had wheeled about to come back, but they were holding off. The sizzling crisp of Gentius's acid was sharp in the air for anyone to smell if only they put out their tongue, and though it was dark, the fires leaping up from the camp glowed red against Temeraire's belly, and Majestatis, and Requiescat, and Ballista, enough to make it plain that there were four heavyweights lined up opposite. Quickly Temeraire turned and roared out,
"Chalcedony, go round and at them!"
"What?"
Chalcedony called back, circling himself in mid-air to try and keep his place. He and the other yellow reapers and middleweights were in a great mass, waiting for their turn to have a go at the camp.
"The Chevaliers! All of you circle about and come at them from behind! Make them come towards us!"
Temeraire called back, impatiently.
"Oh!"
Chalcedony said, and the reapers jumped at it, streamed out in a flock, and whipped around the Chevaliers.
"Second line!"
Temeraire cried, and the angle wings and grey coppers all darted down in a pair of short rows and made another pass through the camp crosswise to the one the heavyweights had made. They were all middle and lightweights, but so especially quick and skilful they were hard to hit even under the best of circumstances, and the soldiers had all been aiming their guns up at the heavyweights in wholly the wrong direction, so the circumstances were not at all the best, for the French anyway. But a great many of the angle wings were vain of their flying, and instead of going straight through, Velocitas and Palliatier and a few of the others were stopping abruptly mid-flight, cornering neat as a box and darting back the way they had come a little, then reversing again and doing complicated interweaving tricks of flying. It was all just showing away, and Temeraire frowned at it because they were taking a great deal longer than they ought and would get shot. And anyway, it was meant to be the heavyweight's turn to go again. But he supposed that was selfish, and they would have some splendid fighting with the Chevaliers instead. But when he looked, the Chevaliers were not coming towards them. They were too busy trying to defend themselves. The reapers were darting at them in pairs, one from either flank, and as soon as the Chevalier turned to meet that attack, another pair would go at them from another direction. The reapers were coming at them from below, so the men aboard the Chevaliers could not shoot them very easily.
"Oh,"
Temeraire said, disgruntled. It was being very neatly done, but that was not what he had wanted at all. At least the grey coppers were behaving in a more practical way. While the angle wings made their fuss, the lightweights were snatching up anything that came handy, tent-poles or young trees that came away from the ground, and whacking away at the camp with them, knocking down people and tents, and spreading the fires even more.
"There goes a gun," Magistatus said laconically, pointing with his long talons.
The French had managed to pull round one of their cannon the right way, despite the confusion, and a dozen men aiming pepper-guns were standing with it.
"Come away!"
Temeraire called down hurriedly.
"Velocitas! Palliatia! Oh, they're not listening!"
And they paid for it. The cannon fired, canister shot. The pepper guns spat, and a general shriek went up from the angle wings as the balls scattered over them.
"Quick, Magistatus, we are fastest!"
"Hey, I ain't going to just sit here,"
Requiescat said, but Temeraire was already diving, roaring.
"The gun for me,"
Magistatus called as they plummeted, and he managed to bang over the hot cannon as he shot past, his wickedly long claws slashing ruin among the artillerymen. Temeraire went for the angle wings, bullying them along and up again, and nudging a shoulder under Velocitas, who had gotten worst hit, a pepper ball right in the face. His golden-yellow head was speckled black and red everywhere, and his eyes and nostrils were already swollen up so dreadfully he could not see. Streams of mucus dripping away from his face. He was moaning wretchedly. And then Requiescat came down behind them, going too fast for his weight, and bowled through everyone, crashing through the camp with his wings spread, trying to slow himself, and knocking soldiers and dragons both every which way as he drove a massive furrow down the middle of the campground with his talons and his tail.
"Aloft!"
Temeraire called furiously, squirming himself free of several tents, and shaking off a couple of soldiers who had been thrown on his leg.
"Everyone aloft! At once!"
He punctuated the order with a roar, a proper one which he aimed towards the caissons of ammunition stacked neatly by the guns. The pyramids of round-shot trembled and collapsed, balls rolling everywhere across the ground, crushing men's legs, and the dragons all leapt aloft in the fresh confusion.
"Look! Look!"
cried Fricatio, one of the grey coppers, as he climbed up.
"Look, I caught a horse!"
waving it in his talons.
"This is no time to be eating," Temeraire said.
But it reminded him of their real purpose, and he went up a little more to see. Sure enough, there were a great many shadows moving about near the pigs, and the gate of the pen was swinging wide open.
"We have the pigs!"
he cried, and everyone cheered noisily, and Temeraire added,
"Now we can go."
"Why?"
Magistatus said.
"What?"
Temeraire said. "Why ought we go?" Magistatus said, and pointed down. All the soldiers were fleeing in a body eastward, routed, only stopping long enough to heave the wounded upon wagons and drag them away. Aloft, the chevaliers were turning tail and going too, and the camp in all its flames was left deserted to its conquerors.
"Well,"
Temeraire said the next morning, peering down the slightly charred barrel,
"it is very nice, but I'm not sure what we can do with it."
"Drop it on their heads next battle," Monsey suggested.
"Listen to you talk. We shan't waste a real cannon like that,"
Gentius said.
"What we need is some men to fire it for us, a proper artillery company. And we need some proper surgeons, too,"
he added,
"for us and for them,"
meaning the prisoners, most of them wounded who had been left behind on the field. There were not very many of these. By the time the dragons had managed to put out the fires, nearly all the casualties were dead. Lloyd and the men had helped the survivors away and put up a tent for them, but that left all the dead men lying about. The battle had been very satisfying, if not quite as long or as ordered as one might have wished, and Temeraire was not sorry to have killed the soldiers. It was just as well, since otherwise they would have had to fight them again, and, after all, they had invaded. But he was sorry they were dead, and it made one rather sad to look at them. Most of the ferals did not see what the difficulty was, and a couple were for eating them. Temeraire flattened his ruff in horror, and everyone else hissed disapprovingly, so this suggestion was withdrawn.
"Yes, that is enough of that kind of talk,"
Gentius said,
"but we can't leave them lying about either. They ain't fitting. They were good enemies."
So a couple of the reapers had dug a grave, perhaps a little deep, some 20 foot, and the couriers had collected up the dead and put them inside. And after they had filled the hole in, Chalcedony had respectfully stuck one of the least charred French flags upright into the mound, and they had all bowed their heads solemnly for a moment, and then they had eaten some pigs. Now they were beginning the work of picking through the remains of the camp. Most things had been burnt up, but for metal pots, buckles, cannon shot, and, most excitingly, a great solid lump of gold, a heap of sovereigns melted altogether, which had been found in the charred remains of a chest. Reedley had nosed it out onto the ground in front of all of them, and many heads had craned forward to look at it in admiration. It shone brilliantly in the morning sun.
"Well, how is it to be shared out?"
Requiescat said, eyeing it covetously.
"We must put it aside somewhere safe," Tamerer said, "and when the war is over, we will take all the treasure we have gotten, like this, and have some splendid pavilions built all over which we can all use whenever we like, which will be better than for us all to have only enough to buy a piece of a pavilion in only one place. And what is left over we will use to get medals for everyone, and everyone will have a medal to suit their size."
All approving this arrangement, a few dragons were detailed off, after complicated negotiations resulting in Reedley, Chalcedony, and another Yellow Reaper, and an Anglewing, all going together, when Reedley could easily have carried it alone, to escort the gold chunk to a place of safety back in the breeding grounds. The rest of them had fallen back to searching the camp with even more enthusiasm than before. Then they had uncovered the cannon. Most of the guns had been ruined. Those whose housings were not burnt or acid-eaten had been spiked by their crews before being abandoned. One, however, under the protective weight of a smothering tent, had escaped destruction. It was a little pitted, and its wheels were perhaps a bit singed along the edge, but it was a real great gun, a good 12-pounder, and they had plenty of balls around for it. There was even a store of gunpowder left, as the wagon full of powder had been kept some distance away from the rest of the camp.
"But how are the men to know what is to be done if they are not already soldiers?"
Temeraire said. He had seen the guns fired many times aboard ship, but he did not recall perfectly just how it was managed.
"Perhaps Persaitia can work out—"
He looked and realized she was not poking through the camp with the others, but was sitting near the waterhole, curled up in a lump.
"Are you hurt?"
he inquired, having gone over to her.
"Of course I'm not hurt," she said snappishly.
"Why are you sitting over here, then, instead of coming to see? We have found some gold already, and maybe there is more."
"Well, it is not as though I will have a share," she said. "I did not do any fighting."
"Everyone had a chance," Temeraire said, injured.
He did not feel he had been unfair. Naturally, the heavyweights ought to go first, if they could do the worst. Persaitia looked away and hunched her wings more snugly.
"You may go away, if all you mean is to sneer and be unpleasant. I'm sure it is no business of anyone's if I did not care to fight."
"I am not sneering at all, and you may stop being so quarrelsome," Temeraire said. "I did not notice that you did not fight."
She fidgeted a little and muttered by way of apology,
"Others did,"
glancing towards the other dragons.
"But why did you not, if you mind so much now?" Temeraire asked. "You might have, any time you liked."
"I did not like," she said defiantly. "So there. And you may call me a coward if you want. I am sure I do not care."
"Oh,"
Temeraire said, and sat back on his haunches. He was not quite sure what to say.
"I am very sorry," he offered uncertainly.
He supposed it must be very unpleasant to be a coward, but he had always thought cowards were wretched creatures who would do something unpleasant, such as steal your things, even if they knew they could not win fighting for them. And that was not what Persaitia was like at all.
"And you are never shy of quarrelling with anyone?"
"That is not the same," she said. "One does not get shot for quarrelling, or have a wing torn up, or a cannonball in the chest. I saw a dragon take a cannonball once. It was dreadful."
"Of course," Temeraire said. "But one must just be quick enough, and then you can dodge them."
"That is nonsense," she said. "A musket ball can go much quicker than any dragon, so it is all decided by chance before you ever think of evading, or even notice that someone is shooting at you. If you are very quick, of course, then you are gone before they can have fired very often," she added, "so your chances are better, but they are best if you do not go anywhere in front of a gun at all. And I'm not very quick."
Temeraire rubbed the side of a talon against his forehead, pondering.
"In China," he said, "only some kinds of dragons fight at all. A great many of them are scholars, and would not know what to do in a battle at all. No one thinks any less of them, or calls them cowards. I suppose that is what you are."
She lifted her head, and Temeraire added,
"Anyway, we are all perfectly happy to fight, so there is no sense in your doing it, when you dislike it."
"Well, I think just the same," she said, brightening. "Only I do not like anyone to say I did not do my part. But there is no part other than fighting."
"We must work out how to use the gun," Tamara said. "That would be very useful, and perhaps you can think of something we might do with it to help us fighting. And that is a fair share, as no one else knows how to do it."
This solution so suited her that by the end of the day she had a dozen men working busily as a gun crew. These had come to them, along with another 30, from the local militia, who had rather nervously come to the battlefield in the morning with their muskets to see what had happened during the night. Reassured by the gaily flapping flags, they had come near enough to be pressed into service with cheerful ruthlessness by Lloyd and his fellows, tired of being hands for nearly 60 dragons as well as herdsmen. The militiamen were abjured not to be such lumps when they cringed from Pasitia in fear, and lectured with great pomp by Lloyd on the need to stop Bonaparte, and then surrendered to her tender mercies. They spent the day working through the mechanics of the gun-firing, the swabbing, the wadding, steps Pasitia had pieced together by interrogating the men on how their muskets were fired, and then every dragon who had ever been in service on board a ship or in a fleet action and seen the great guns go. It had been a little difficult. Everyone remembered the sequence a little differently, and for a moment they were at a standstill until she hit upon the notion of making a tally, of which order everyone recalled, and taking the most popular. By evening they successfully launched their first round shot across the camp with a bang, to the great startlement of all the other dragons, napping full of pork and satisfaction.
"If we could only work out a way for it to slide properly, there's no reason you might not take it aloft," she said wistfully that evening, coming to join the discussion with all her old sense of assurance restored.
She would happily have kept working, but her men having grown sufficiently used to her, their remnants of fear had at last been outweighed by their fatigue, and they had rebelled and demanded a chance to sleep and eat.
"At least maybe Requiescat might, and it could be set off upon his back. But the recoil, that is the difficulty."
"What to do next? That is the difficulty," Temeraire said,
and bent his head over the information which Monsey had brought and sketched out into maps, wondering how they might learn what the French would do next, and how soon he might bring them to another battle.
Chapter 6
"Sir," Holland said, "I don't like to make you think of it, but with him loose this long, gone this far off from the grounds, it stands to reason he isn't flying wild. He has gone to look for you."
"I know,"
Lawrence said. If Temeraire had gone to Dover, he had flown straight into the arms of Napoleon's invading army, and Lawrence could not follow. Jane's very justification for retrieving him from prison at all had been to keep him out of French hands. Already he was 4 days overdue in camp, or generously three, and their absence would reflect on her just when she most needed all forces of persuasion aligned in her favour to prepare for Napoleon's inevitable march on London. He knew what duty demanded: return and report his failure, and wait until some word at last came in of Temeraire's fate. To sit in jail endlessly, with no notion of what had happened to Temeraire, Lawrence did not know how he would bear it. But there was no other alternative. Already he had likely injured Holland's career, if so much prior association with him had not been tarnish enough, as he had injured Jane and Ferris and so many others, as if he had not already done enough harm.
"We might go another day," Holland suggested. "Work our way back towards the army, sir, asking along the way, and maybe see what anyone has heard about the French. It stands to reason the generals would want to know that anyway, sir."
Lawrence knew he ought to refuse it. It was generosity offered from friendship, not Holland's real and considered judgment.
"Thank you, Holland, if you think it justified," he said at last. "The internal struggle lost, or at least some ground yielded. But we shall go back straight towards the camp," he added, to win back a little of it, and try to persuade himself perhaps Temeraire had heard somehow of the main body of the army and gone there. They might find him in Woolwich, waiting. But no, that passed the limits of optimism. Temeraire was not waiting anywhere, if he knew where Lawrence was, and likely even if he had not the slightest idea. He had crossed half of Africa without the least notion and found Lawrence in the middle of an unfamiliar continent. He would certainly not be discouraged by the need to search all of Britain, if need be, even in the middle of a war, and as like as not get himself hurt thereby. They flew much interrupted, stopping at any farm with a herd of moderate size, and at any towns with a clearing large enough for a courier.
but they got no news, or at least none they wanted.
"Pass 20 of my sheep, but not to any dragons. To the French, damn they eyes,"
one angry herdsman informed them.
"They are so close," Lawrence said in dismay.
They were yet west of London than he would have imagined the French had come, much farther, even in small parties. The man spat.
"Came through here yesterday, pillaging buggers, begging your pardon, sir, but it is enough to make a saint swear. 3 of my best ewes going into their bellies, and a stud, all because that lunkhead boy of mine didn't get them into the hills in time. But there, who thought they would be here so soon?"
The mayor of Twickenham confirmed the French presence.
"We have heard from Richmond they were dropped in," he said, "dragon back, and they've been all up and down this countryside thieving. Our lads are gone to fight them, north of here. There's been a militia mustered up round Richmond. There are some dragons with them there, sir, as a courier came here to fetch out our boys, as they had heard nothing yet of what to do. But of any loose dragons, not a thing have I heard. We will be sure and keep our cattle under cover, though, you may be sure."
He gave them dinner, very kindly, and waved away Holland's offer of payment, if he accepted it for the goat which went to feed Elsie. The mayor's wife and oldest girl, a few years out of the schoolroom, ate with them, and Lawrence was occasionally recalled to his manners enough to make some little conversation, but he was too burdened to be fit company. This fresh intelligence meant they must go back at once. The generals must know the French had penetrated this far.
"There were some eagles, I hear," the young woman ventured. "Georgie said afore he went, the boys from Ham saw 2 of them."
That was bad, very bad. 2 French regiments, and so far from the bulk of Napoleon's army, that likely meant a marshal somewhere in the area. The worst of the marshals were competent alone. Acting as the hands of their chief, they were dangerous as vipers. There was nothing strategic to be won here, in the west of England, but a great deal of food. Food which would keep those French dragons in the air.
"Had they cavalry?"
he asked abruptly, raising his head.
"I beg your pardon,"
he added, realizing belatedly he had interrupted a conversation which had moved on without him. Holin and the young lady had been talking about the places which he saw on his route.
"Oh, I'm sorry, sir. I don't remember Georgie saying so,"
she said, abashed at being addressed.
"But I think they do not, Captain," the mayor said. "They came on foot here, anyway."
If Napoleon had thrown all his lot onto air power, Lawrence was not sure what it might mean. It disregarded all established wisdom about modern warfare, which held that a properly organized force of cavalry and infantry together, supported by pepper guns and artillery, could repel virtually any dragon attack. But no one had ever heard of a dragon attack of more than 50 dragons before Napoleon's first attempt at crossing the Channel in the year 5. Lawrence remembered their general astonishment at his managing to bring together a force of 100 beasts. He went outside after the meal and waited politely and dully, while Holland took Miss—the name had already escaped Lawrence—to see Elsie by her nervous request. The dragon was interested to meet her. Ladies not common company for dragons, but for the female captains, who rarely dressed for their natural station, and Elsie was quite willing to be petted, and offered a blancmange the young lady had made, which she politely licked up from the serving plate in a couple of swipes.
"Why, what a lovely plate,"
she said after, with much more enthusiasm, and was visibly sorry to see it drawn back, as it had a gaily painted border in red and blue, with a few small touches of silver.
"I have never seen anything so pretty,"
Elsie added, stretching her head to look at it again.
"Why, it is only an old—"
the girl said, and then quickly swallowed the rest, and added,
"which I have painted over. I am sure you may have it, if you like it so." "Oh?"
Elsie said, and said urgently to Holland,
"Will you keep it for me, and perhaps it might be washed and packed away safe?"
This took another half an hour to be done to her satisfaction, with much bobbing of heads and exchanges of compliments on both sides, a happy conversation which went past in a buzz of noise for Lawrence, until at last he made an effort and forced himself to say abruptly,
"Holland, we had better be going."
"Oh," the girl said, "but shan't you wait for him?"
She pointed, and they looked to see another dragon in the sky, coming in their direction.
"A fine thing,"
Miller said.
"A fine thing! Expected 4 days ago in camp, and I find you here, Captain Holin, wandering around where you oughtn't be, and taking a convicted felon into good society."
Holin flushed and said sharply, "If I've done wrong, Captain Miller, you may be sure I will explain myself to those as has the right to ask me to account for it. We have been looking for the dragon we were sent to fetch, seeing as how those fellows in the breeding ground have forgot their duty and gone, and the beasts all scattered."
"'What?'
Miller said, forgetting to be pompous in his alarm.
"'All of them gone? Out of the grounds? Where have they got to? What have they been eating?'
Miller's courier beast Devastatio was markedly smaller than Elsie, who was big for a Winchester. Holland had known better than most new young courier captains how to see about the proper feeding of a dragon, and he had already been on friendly terms with most of the herdsmen around the bigger coverts, a further advantage. Devastatio had landed showily, nearly strutting the last few strides into the clearing, and having realized too late he was outweighed, was now trying his best to puff out his chest and surreptitiously to climb upon a hillock. Elsie eyed him puzzledly, and then offered,
"'Would you like to see my plate?'
"'Gentlemen,'
Lawrence said sharply, seeing Miller dragging Holland through all the narrative of their search.
"'We have no time for this. The French have been sighted nearby, and we must go and bring the intelligence to camp at once. We already know about the French being here. There has been some fighting,' Miller said. "'Some bright militia officer has raised the countryside and beat them properly over at Wembley and at Harlesden last night. That is why we are here. I am carrying a colonel's commission for him.'
"'Oh,'
the young lady said, having hung back a little from their conversation.
"'Have they beat at Harlesden? Georgie will have been there. I must go tell Mother.'
She half turned, then turned back and curtsied, and then hesitantly raised her hand a little, and Holland, stepping towards her, brought it to his lips, also a little hesitantly, and said,
"'Your servant, Miss Jempson, and I hope my rounds might bring me again.'
"'I hope so too,'
she said, pink, and having dared so far, turned and fled.
"'Sir, if the news is in and Miller will tell them where we are, we might keep looking,' Holland said, turning back, his own cheeks a little ruddy. "'Oh, no, no, thank you, there'll be none of that,' Miller said. "'Your orders is not to be wandering over all creation, it is to go and get the dragon and come back. Well, if you haven't got the dragon, you can do what is left, and that is to come back. If they want you to keep looking, they will tell you so. We will fly in company, like we ought when there is news like this to be bringing back, in case one of us is brought down. 100 dragons out wild, eating people as like as cows? I don't know what you was thinking, not to return at once, except to save the neck of one as don't deserve. Captain Miller,
Holland said.
Enough,
Lawrence said.
I do not intend to be the subject of quarrelling in circumstances such as these. Captain Holland, we had some rational hope of finding Temeraire quickly, having arrived so shortly after the dispersal of the breeding grounds. Now we can have none. I am very sensible of your generosity, but will not trespass upon it further. Let us go at once.
He had steeled himself to it, and now wanted nothing more than to have it over. The quicker he returned, the less damage would be done by his having kept them out, selfishly, further contrary to his duty. Success only could have made it forgivable. Even then he ought to have been reproached. Granby was right all along. His discipline had been wholly corrupted, Lawrence saw now. Perhaps the effects were all the worse because he had not been brought up properly within the corps, and had let the sudden liberty of the service, looser by necessity than the navy, go to his head completely and become license. He swung himself up and over onto Elsie after Holland had climbed up, and silently strapped himself in, heavy with self-reproach. He had no attention for their surroundings or the journey, and let the cold wind coming in their faces make him dull. Devastatio flung himself ahead, far of Elsie, by way of further self-puffery, which he was able to manage as she was burdened by two instead of one. It was all that saved them. Because of the distance, the Petit Chevalier could not come at them together, and so he bore down on Devastatio alone in the lead. The little Winchester squalled and tumbled straight down, blood streaming from his wing and side where he had been savagely clawed. He managed to right himself with great hissing gulps of breath, puffing out his sides until his fall slowed enough for him to gain purchase, but he was not flying properly, only able to limp half-skewed to the ground. Satisfied that he had been grounded and might be retrieved at leisure, the Petit Chevalier wheeled about and turned his attention to Elsie. The name of the French breed was appropriate only by comparison with the Grand Chevalier. The heavyweight coming towards them was some 18 tons, his claws already stained with Devastatio's blood, and he roared threateningly as he came on. Elsie gave a small desperate gasp and dived out of his way. She twisted nearly upside down to evade, setting Lawrence and Holland both dangling from their straps, and shot forward with all her might past the great dragon's belly, rifle shot from the bellman, whistling like wasps past their heads. But she was too weighted down to get her full speed. The Petit Chevalier doubled back on himself and set in steady pursuit. Over distance his strength would tell, and he would have them if she could not escape before then. And he was fast enough to keep her in his sights an hour, Lawrence judged, looking down over Elsie's side to watch the dragon's shadow flashing by over the ground. It came chasing after Elsie's smaller shadow like a racing cloud, pouring up and down the curves of the hills, darkening slopes and sending deer bounding away through the trees. The outline of the dragon remained steady as the ground rolled away beneath them with blazing speed, at least 25 knots, with the wind howling and tearing at their clothing no matter how low they crouched against Elsie's neck. The Petit Chevalier roared behind them. Lawrence could not lift his head up into the wind to look back, but they were over a broad stretch of farmland, fields in neat, snow-powdered squares bordered by roads, so the dragon shapes made perfect silhouettes upon white. And as Elsie's first desperate sprinting failed, the distance between the two shadows began, slowly and inexorably, to narrow. And then, sliding into place behind the Petit Chevalier's shape, a third shadow joined the line, beginning first as a small speck, and rapidly growing larger and larger and larger, until at last it swallowed up the other, and with a dreadful shattering roar a tremendous regal copper came thundering down from above. The enormous red and gold beast pounced directly upon the Petit Chevalier, serving him out with the very trick he had used on Devastatio, and without any restraint bowled him over and down. The two heavyweights went tumbling head over heels, snarling and snapping wildly, uncontrolled. A couple of men went flying wildly off the French dragon's back, and munitions, bombs, and rifles tumbling loose towards the countryside. Lawrence had no idea how the regal copper's crew were managing, and then he realized the dragon had no harness at all. Elsie was panting as she slowed, curving in a wide arc so they could look back at the titanic struggle.
"Oh, I am glad," Elsie said, gulping air between words. "I am not quite sure I could have run away from that big French one."
"I hope we may not need to run away from that other fellow,"
Holland said, a sentiment which Lawrence shared. The regal copper outweighed the other dragon by at least another 7 or 8 tons. He had now got his claws into the Chevalier's shoulders, and was scratching at him with his hind legs, shaking him all the time so the riflemen could not get their feet enough to fire at him properly. And the handful of wild shots which they managed did not trouble him greatly. It was a savage style of fighting, and if cruder than formation flying, on the level of such an individual contest, the unexpected ferocity told worse than discipline. The Chevalier squalled at last, frantically, and with a great convulsive heave managed to tear himself free, leaving great torn gashes in his flesh, 3 furrows along each shoulder, almost like bars of rank. He bolted headlong away, leaving the regal copper in possession of the field. The victorious beast spread his wings, glowing vividly red with the sun behind them, and roared triumphantly after the Petit Chevalier, a great deep bellowing noise like hosts of thunder. And then the regal copper turned to look at them and said, in tones of great disapproval,
"Well, and what are you about? I don't think much of your sense, taking on a fellow that size."
"Pray," Elsie said timidly, "we didn't mean to. Only he came on us all of a sudden, and Devastatio is hurt."
"Oh, there is another of you."
The regal turned and scanned over the ground. They had drifted some way off in the fighting, and Devastatio had tried to drag himself under some trees for concealment. But regal coppers had tolerable eyesight from a sufficient distance, and after a bit of scanning about, he said,
"Ha! There he is,"
and flew over to the hiding place, landing with a tremendous thump.
"You lot were all told this morning not to come round here," the big dragon said severely, nosing over Devastatio's wounds. "I said those big Frenchies were going to be going up and down carrying soldiers about all this way, didn't I? This is going to be nasty healing." "We were told nothing of the sort," Miller said, having to lean rather frantically away to keep from being squashed by the prodding.
The regal jerked his head back in surprise, and then put it further back, squinting at them rather uselessly.
"Is that a man? Why? You are under harness," he said, exclaiming, and turned to squint at Elsie. "Both of you."
"Of course they are," Miller said,
and added with what Lawrence had to admit was marked courage, if not much sense of gratitude,
"Why are you flying about wild like this? Why have you gone out of the breeding grounds?"
"Hum," the regal copper said. "I am no hand at explaining things, so I suppose you had better come along with me and talk to the commander."
"What do you mean, commander?" Miller said, bewildered. "Are you fighting with the militia?"
"Yes, all those fellows are with us," the regal copper said. "Come on, then, up you get," he added to Devastatio.
The Winchester sniffed a little, still licking at his wounds a bit more, but obeyed, climbing awkwardly up onto the enormous dragon's back. The regal copper went up with a tremendous, propelling leap, took on a little height, and ponderously began to flap away, Elsie darting after him anxiously. The flight was short, despite his slow pace, and he astonishingly landed them just outside the edges of a vast and neatly organized camp. Lawrence had a glimpse of many dragons lying about in the clearing as they landed, and a large pen full of enormous black pigs. The regal padded along a broad, cleared lane through the trees towards the heart of the camp, only to pull up short when a little Winchester, also without any harness, popped up on the border and said loudly,
"Stop, and give the watchword."
"It's me, isn't it?" the regal copper said. "And these two are with me, so they're all right, too."
"That don't matter," the Winchester said stubbornly. "Everyone must give the watchword, or else I'm to yell." "But," he said hastily, as the regal copper lowered his head, snorting, "I suppose that don't mean you," and hopped aside.
Lawrence was startled to find a commander who had so little prejudice against unharnessed dragons that he had somehow conceived both to recruit them and make use of them in such a fashion. He wondered if the man could have some experience of the corps, if he had a relation, or perhaps had lived near a covert. It made a solution twice over, both to keep the dragons from roving wild across the countryside pillaging, and to strengthen his own militia force greatly. It did puzzle Lawrence to see a dragon put on watch duty, but perhaps it would serve all the better to put off any spies. Miller's expression, where he sat perched up on the regal beside Devastatio, stroking the injured dragon, suggested he was less impressed than scandalized to see beasts without harness and serving in such a role. For his part, the regal did not seem to think much of it either.
"What things are coming to, I am sure I don't know," he said, shaking his head as he padded along. "It is all well and good to be talking on about pavilions and such."
And Lawrence felt a great leap of hope, even before the regal brought them out into the clearing at the centre of the camp and said,
"Temeraire, there are some fellows here to see you."
And Lawrence flung loose his carabiner straps and leapt down from Elsie's back to see the great black head swinging around towards him.
"It is very well to have an eagle," Temeraire said. It was a particularly bright gold now they had washed all the dirt from it. Everyone had been ready to help, and the standard with it was very handsome too, now the men had brushed it clean. It would be quite a wrench to sell it, he felt, and the way everyone else looked at it, he expected they felt the same. "But we must not begin to think we will have things all our own way. There have not been very many French dragons to fight yet, because they are all busy carrying about the men. But sooner or later we will have to manage them."
"I have some notions," Posaitia said, "which we might like to try when we have more to fight."
"Hi, Temeraire,"
Requiescat said, coming into the clearing behind him. Temeraire looked around and saw there was an injured Winchester on his back, and another trotting along behind him, with his old ground crew master, Hollin, on her back. Requiescat was still talking, and Posaitia going on about Pepper, but Temeraire did not perfectly understand either of them, and the words did not seem to want to make sense. That was Lawrence coming towards him. But Lawrence was dead. And he was saying,
"Temeraire, thank heavens! I've been trying to find you these last 5 days."
"But you are dead," Temeraire said uneasily.
He had never seen a ghost, and had often thought it would be very interesting. But this was not at all. It was dreadful to see Lawrence just as in life, to wish that he might reach out and gather him in and keep him safe. But Lawrence said,
"Of course I'm not dead, my dear. I'm here."
And Temeraire bent down his head and peered at Lawrence very closely, and put out his tongue experimentally to sniff at him, and then at last he cautiously, so cautiously, put out his forehand to curl about Lawrence and lift him up, and, oh, he was quite solid. He was there, and he was not dead at all. And Temeraire gave a low, joyful cry and curled around him tightly and said,
"Oh, Lawrence, I shall never let anyone take you from me again."
Part 2, Chapter 7.
"No, They nearly drowned you, and not even on purpose, but only through carelessness. I'm not letting them have you back, Temeraire said. Besides, I cannot go. I cannot just leave everyone here.
You are more desperately needed with the main force, Lawrence said, trying to explain, the obstinate gleam in Temeraire's eye discouraging. We must speak to the commander.
I am the commander, Temeraire said.
Lawrence stared up at his earnest expression from within the protective wall of dragon encircling him, and then, pulling himself up onto the ridge of Temeraire's forearm, looked more closely around the clearing. There was not a senior officer to be seen, anywhere, and none of the dragons, many of them regarding him with equal curiosity, were harnessed. Besides the enormous Regal, an old Longwing lay with milky orange eyes half-lidded sleepily, and a big checkered nettle, a Parnassian, and scattered smaller dragons all around. Beyond them, Lawrence could see the camp all full of dragons, yellow reapers by the dozens, sleeping nearly in a single heap, and small courier beasts and lightweights sprawled upon them everywhere. There were a handful of men dealing with the pigs and a few cattle penned up to one side, but they were in rough clothing, not officers of the corps. Some few hundred in red coats, mostly faded to russet, standing by the guns, and some volunteers in private coats. That was all.
The militia, Lawrence said slowly.
Yes, Lloyd and some of our herdsmen told us where to fetch them, Temeraire said. They are very good fellows, once they settled down at least, and began to believe we were not going to eat them. We needed them to fire our guns.
Good God, Lawrence said comprehensively.
He could well and vividly imagine the reaction which the Lords of the Admiralty should have to the intelligence that the well-formed, orderly militia which they confidently expected, with a clever young officer at its head, was rather an experimental and wholly independent legion of unharnessed dragons, without great sympathy for their lordships, and under the particular command of the most recalcitrant dragon in all Britain.
Well, Temeraire said, when he had listened to Lawrence's awkward attempt to explain the orders which had brought them here and the misunderstanding, it does not seem at all complicated to me. They did not say you were only to give the commission if the commander were a man? He asked, lowering his head towards Miller.
Why not? No, Miller said, staring. But
then it is perfectly plain, Temeraire said, riding over him. I shall write and say I am happy to accept my commission, and apologize that my duty to the regiment prevents my returning with Lawrence at present. They cannot complain of that. Anyway, we must send at once to warn them. Napoleon will be attacking London in 2 days.
A more sensational means of diverting their attention he could hardly have conjured. Lawrence did not know what to think at first. Temeraire had, perhaps, a dragon's idea of distances, and did not appreciate the difficulties inherent in moving so many men and horses and their supply from a landing on a hostile shore to assault. It had not yet been a week since the landings on the Channel coast. Without opposition in that time, Bonaparte might have marched his men in a long string to the city, but as an army, ready to fight, no. Lawrence relied on it, or he wished to rely on it, but he recalled too vividly the thunder of the guns at Warsaw a month and more before the French ought to have been there either, and doubted uneasily.
"Can you be certain?"
"We have been watching Marshal Lefebvre's corps," Temeraire said. "They had orders this morning and set off directly, and they have been moving soldiers about all of today towards London. Requiescat saw them."
"Requiescat?" Lawrence said.
"You have met him. He brought you here," Temeraire said.
"He cannot have got very close."
Unnoticed, Lawrence said. A regal copper was an odd choice of spy.
Oh, he did not try to sneak, Temeraire said. No one very much likes to start a quarrel with him, you see, so he could come close before they were quite ready to fight him, and when the French could see no one was with him, they supposed he was run away from the breeding grounds and looking for other dragons to have some company. So they were very eager to tempt him to stay, and they put out cows for him in their camp. It was much easier than if we had to feed him ourselves, and he was able to see everything they were doing.
"Which is hieing themselves off towards the city," Requiescat put in. "They was all looking for us before then, as we had blacked their eye a couple of times. But soon as the orders came in, off they went, and they sent all the cattle on ahead,"
he finished, in gloomy tones.
"Black their eye?" Miller said with a snort. "Yes, damned likely."
"Like enough," Holland said, and pointed.
Lawrence looked, An eagle standard was jutting from the ground, the 13th Regiment blazoned on the banner.
"I'll take the news, sir," Holland added, looking at Lawrence. "Me and Elsie can make the dash quick on our own and let them know."
"Damn nonsense," Miller said. "The news you ought to be taking is there are 60 dragons as need rounding up and herding back to the breeding grounds."
He cut off abruptly, as Temeraire took a step and lowered his head very close.
"We are not going to be herded anywhere we do not like," he said dangerously, "by Napoleon or by your admirals. If you like to ask the other dragons of the corps to try it, I expect they will see at once how very foolish it is, and if not, I will explain it to them, and I dare say they will join us instead."
Lawrence had a fair notion which dragons would be perfectly prepared to join Temeraire under such circumstances, with very little explanation required. That would bring the tally to 2 long wings, even if one of them was surely past his real fighting days, and 2 regal coppers, to join with the 5 other heavyweights Lawrence could see, and a full complement of middleweights and couriers, which would make Temeraire's army very nearly the equal to the corps in strength, at least those forces presently in England and under harness. If he were not fully aware of these prospects, Miller was wise enough to blanch at the suggestion and to be quelled at least a little. He settled for writing a letter in a quiet corner, while Temeraire dictated his own.
"Gentlemen, I am very happy to accept your commission, and we should like to be the 81st Regiment if that number is not presently taken. We do not need any rifles, and we have got plenty of powder and shot for our cannons."
Lawrence wrote with a vivid awareness of the reactions this should produce.
"But we are always in need of more cows and pigs and sheep, and goats would also do, if a good deal easier to come by. Lloyd and our herdsmen have done very well, and I should like to commend them to your attention. But there are a lot of us, and some more herdsmen would be very useful."
"Pepper, put in Pepper,"
another dragon said, craning her head over. She was a middleweight, yellowish-striped with grey, some kind of cross-breed.
"And canvas! We must have a lot of canvas!"
"Oh, very well, Pepper," Temeraire said, and continuing his list of requests added, "I should very much like Canes to come here, and also Gong Su, and Emily Rowland, who has my talon sheaths, and the rest of my crew. And also we need some surgeons for the wounded men. Dorset had better come, too, and some other dragon surgeons. You had all better not stay where you are at present."
"Temeraire, you cannot write so to your superior officers,"
Lawrence said, breaking off. He had foregone any attempt at explaining that the commission should be instantly withdrawn, and had swallowed many protests already on the language of the letter in favour of getting its urgent news sent quickly. Jane would understand it, at least, but there were limits.
"But they really had better not," Temeraire said, surprised. "They have not got enough soldiers, not anywhere near, because they are not moving quickly enough."
Lawrence persuaded him at last to soften the language.
"Napoleon will be attacking you on Tuesday, with nearly all his army, as the French are going very quickly because they are all being carried about by dragons, and your reinforcements will not reach you in time. Our couriers have seen them on the road, and they are only going 15 miles a day."
"But what if they do not realize that means they ought to retreat?" Temeraire objected.
"They will understand it, I assure you," Lawrence said.
He did not bother to say that they would very likely not believe it, and that nothing would come of Temeraire's advice. In this, at least, he was thoroughly wrong. A great deal came of it, if nothing very desirable. Lawrence awoke the next morning on his dragon-arm pallet to a furious yelling noise outside the sheltering membrane of Temeraire's wing. He was not allowed to get down to his feet. He was snatched at once and put on Temeraire's back by the breastplate chain, and then Temeraire pushed himself up to his feet just as a couple of courier weights came bounding in urgently from the boundary line of the camp, half flying and half leaping, and gasped out,
"Temeraire, she hasn't the watchword, but I do not need any silly watchword,"
Iskiaka said, padding into the clearing, and coiled herself back on her hindquarters and snorted a thin stream of fire for emphasis, and the whole mess of the Turkestan ferals came tumbling along behind her.
"What do you want?"
Temeraire said very ungraciously. He did not see why Iskiaka had to come along, showing away and making a great noise of herself.
"To fight!" Iskiaka said, as if the answer were obvious. "We are supposed to be in a war, and there's not been any fighting for 4 days, and I've not even been let to go flying anywhere, and—"
She hissed smoke again.
"They came and lectured my Granby when I went out for just a bit of hunting."
"Well, there is about to be a great deal of fighting over there," Temeraire said, "so you ought to go back."
"No, there is not," Iskierka said. "At least, they're not getting ready for any fighting. They said it would be another week before there is a battle. But then we heard that you had had two battles already, and your letter came saying that there was going to be some more, so we have come to have a share of the fighting also. And," she added, "when we have finished and beat Napoleon, I have decided that you may give me an egg."
"Oh," Temeraire said, swelling with indignation, "how very kind. I am to be honoured, I suppose."
"Well, I am much richer than you are," she said, "and also I can breathe fire, so you ought to be."
"I would not give you an egg," Temeraire said, "if you were the very last dragon in the world, but me. I should rather have none at all."
"You haven't," Iskierka said. "No one has got an egg by you at all yet, so you see, I am very generous to try."
This was no comfortable news, and Temeraire drew back a little, startled. He had not been very enthusiastic about all the breeding by the end, but one could not help but be satisfied at being wanted, and think how many eggs there should be. He did not understand why there should be none. It did not sound very well. Not, however, that it made him wish any more to give Iskierka one. She meanwhile preened herself smugly, stretching out her coils in a messy way so everyone would notice her more. She had on a lot of gaudy stuff on her harness, some chains that were probably not real gold at all, and which had in them chips of what were certainly coloured glass, and Temeraire could not help but be conscious that Granby, who was talking with Lawrence and Tharke over by the standard in low voices, was in a very fine green velvet coat, trimmed all over in golden braid, with not one but two swords at his waist, one of them short, but both very brilliantly ornamented at the hilt in fine shining leather sheaths, even if he did not look very happy at present. And Lawrence was in a shabby coat which did not suit him at all. The others were eyeing her with admiration, and Arcady and the other ferals too, all of whom had bright stuff on them, hooked haphazardly onto their harness, and making them look rather like slovenly pirates, Temeraire thought. And Arcady, Temeraire realized in outrage, Arcady had Domain on his back, Domain who was one of his crew. And he said reproachfully to the boy,
"What are you doing with him?"
"He does not know what the other soldiers are saying with the flags," Domain said, looking up. "So I tell him, and then we decide whether to listen. The flags are wrong sometimes," he added.
They had not brought anyone else from his own crew, or any food, or anything useful at all. They had no notion of how they were to be fed or where they were to sleep, and did not respect the order of the camp at all. Ringe, who was rather big for a feral, a good-sized middleweight, tried to shove a yellow reaper out of his place, and so, of course, all the reapers jumped up and hissed at her, and then Arcady and the others jumped in hissing back, and Temeraire had to roar to get all their attention and push them apart.
"You are new, so you must clear your own places," he said sternly.
"Oh, that is easy,"
Iskierka said, and hissed a command to Arcady, who quickly chivied his gang to one side. And she then blasted fire out across a swath of ground at the edge of their clearing, dry leaves crisping up and tree bark popping with sounds like gunfire off the trunks. One old dead pine caught like a torch and went into a perfect crackling blaze, while everyone else squawked and jumped to their feet.
"That is enough," Temeraire said. "You may not go about setting fires in camp. We have powder all about, and you will have us all blown up. Now, put out those trees and clear it properly by pulling them out."
The ferals, in a rather surly way, smothered the flames with dirt and obeyed, but Iskierka did nothing but sit and yawn and observe, while everyone in the camp watched her, rather impressed than otherwise. It was not at all satisfactory, and when he said as much to Poseidia, she added insult to injury by having no sympathy, and saying instead,
"A fire breather will be very useful,"
and showing him several manoeuvres which she had sketched out to make use of Iskierka especially.
"They didn't believe a word of it,"
Granby said to Lawrence, no surprise. He was rather exhausted-looking, and left sweat streaked on his forehead when he rubbed his hand against it.
"The generals, anyway. You may be sure she swallowed it whole, and nothing would do but we would come and fight with you, or else Temeraire would be getting all the glory and prizes. And she wanted an eagle, too, and once she has decided on something, those ferals will follow her to the end of creation."
Arcady was still their leader, but even he had evidently taken to regarding her as a force of nature beyond ordinary leadership, so much treasure had she led them to seizing.
"Roland was damned understanding,"
Granby added.
"She sent a courier after me with orders, after Iskierka had up and gone, put us on detached duty, scouting. So I'm not insubordinate, technically, but—"
He raised his hands helplessly.
"No preparations were made for a French attack?"
Lawrence said, low.
"None whatsoever?"
"To be fair," Granby said, "there is not much they can do. They haven't the men yet. Admiral Roland tried to persuade them we ought to be ferrying in the troops, but to their minds it will only make a mess and mutiny everywhere when the men won't go aboard."
"They might retreat," Tharke said, "rather than wait to be routed."
"Well,"
Granby said, and Lawrence felt much the same. It was one thing to retreat from the coast, having failed to prevent a landing, and another to let London be taken without a shot.
"Is there any hope you are mistaken?"
Lawrence asked Temeraire a little later, after the Ferrells had been settled into the camp.
"They are moving their men somewhere," Temeraire said practically, "and I cannot think where he would move them other than London, where your army is. There are plenty of cows still around here, so it would not be only for food. But if you like, I will ask Monsey and the others to go and see if they can work out where they have gone for certain."
Before this plan could be wholly put into effect, however, it was rendered unnecessary. Elsie came flying desperately into camp, nearly skidding across the ground.
"Hurry! Oh, hurry!" she cried. "They are not attacking tomorrow. They are attacking tonight!"
And Holland came scrambling off her back and said,
"It is all true, sir. The scouts have seen them formed up, not an hour's march away, and there are 10 Fleur-de-Nuys arming to the teeth in their camp."
Lawrence now had opportunity to see for himself how quickly an army of dragons might go when their own camp moved. First, the herd of cattle gone bellowing down the road in a cloud of dust, with the herdsmen beating them along and a few aerial shepherds for encouragement.
"We will meet you at Harpenden," Temeraire said to the chief of the herdsmen, "or send you word there where to bring the cows and along which road, and if you do not hear from us, only make sure they are safe and the French do not get them."
"Aye, sir,"
the man said, touching his forelock quite automatically, and cheerfully shouting to his men, kicked his mule, a placid beast, and moved along. The handful of tents were struck and bundled up, stakes and all, into a crumpled heap upon one large cloth, cooking gear thrown in too, and the great cauldrons all filled with round shot. The middling dragons seized the guns, the militia and the remaining hands clambering up onto the smaller beasts with ropes to secure them.
"It needs less rope, you see," Temeraire explained, "for the little ones to carry, and the men say they like it better if only they can sit astride instead of being cross-legged."
He kept a stern headmaster's eye on the operation, and from time to time darted an anxious glance at Lawrence, as if to gauge his opinion. But there was nothing to complain of at all. As the dragons went aloft, they dipped down over the rear of the moving herd and snatched themselves each some dinner, a cow or a fat pig, sluggish behind the rest, and flew away eating with no evident difficulty in combining the activities, if they spattered themselves somewhat with blood.
"There, now we are ready also," Temeraire said,
and put out his hand for Lawrence to set him up aloft, and with a leap they were up. Not an hour gone by, and beneath them nothing but the bare, untidy field. The flight was desperately quick from necessity, and the dragons flew in no particular order but one great disorganized mass, shifting continuously, or so at first seemed to Lawrence. And then he discovered that the small dragons were dropping back now and again to rest upon the largest. The discovery was realized rather abruptly, when a small, muddy-colored ferrel dropped down on Temeraire's back out of mid-air, and, clutching on, put her head out to peer at Lawrence with rather a critical expression, while she caught her breath with great gulps.
"Will Lawrence at your service?"
Lawrence said cautiously, after a few moments of silent staring.
"Oh, I am Minnow," the dragon said. "Beg pardon, only I was a bit curious because himself was so low over losing you. I wondered if maybe you was different from other men."
Her tone suggested she had found nothing out of the ordinary to admire. Temeraire put his head around indignantly.
"Lawrence is the very best captain there is. We have just been saving everyone and fighting the admirals, so of course we do not have our nicest things with us presently."
"Have you never wanted a companion?"
Lawrence asked the little dragon. A little, a relative term, of course, as her head alone likely outweighed him entirely.
"I have chums enough," she said, "and as for harness, I'm being told always where to go. No thanks very much. I expect it is better for you big fellows. she added to Temeraire, in service, as no one thinks they can bull you into anything you really do not like. But I hear enough from the old couriers to know it isn't for me. Broke down by the time their captains go, and nothing to show for it but harness stripes. There, that has set me right. Off I go, she said, and jumped off again, with no more ceremony than she had arrived, and dashed off again out in front. Lawrence then saw the manoeuvre a common one, and responsible for the greater part of the confusion of shifting beasts. The heavyweights indeed did not much change their positions, but made steady bulwarks in the force, timed to Requiescat's pace, as he was the slowest of them all. The middleweights, with more energy to spare, would occasionally break off and dive, low to the fields, returning now and again with cow, or pig, or sheep, which they either ate themselves, or occasionally brought to the larger dragons.
"Yes, so we needn't all stop," Temeraire said, "and this way no one is hungry when we arrive, not even Requiescat, even if he complains a little anyway, just for show."
"It ain't for show," Requiescat said, swinging his head around. "When I was in real fighting trim, I was 26 tons. I'm not back up to snuff just yet after that nasty cold." A rather mild way of describing the effects of the virulent epidemic, which had struck the regal coppers particularly hard. All of them had lost a great deal of weight, which now was slow to return, although it was difficult to imagine Requiescat might be much larger than he was. They met no opposition along the way, if a few French scouts, but these sighted them and turned and fled at once, bearing the news away. It was too much to hope for that so large a force as they were aloft would go without notice, and if it made Napoleon delay his attack, indeed desirable he should have the news. Their flight bore them over Hammersmith and Kew, the snaking brown ribbon of the Thames with sparkling ice on its edges and a crust of snow, and then over the city itself. Hollin took Elsie out ahead, quick, and threw out signal flags. Then the guns spoke from below, acknowledging, and below people came running into the streets to cheer them on, a heartening noise if made faint by distance. Temeraire called ahead,
"Dirigion, Ventiosa, go ahead so they may see our flags."
And two yellow reapers darted out ahead, red velvet curtains streaming from their grasp. Another 20 minutes' flight brought the army visible, a sea of redcoats in the churned mud and snow of camp. Temeraire took on height as they came in, so he had a clear lane before him, and then, drawing breath, roared. The air before them was cold, and full of fragile wisps of white cloud, and these gave an ephemeral physical form to the terrible ringing force of the divine wind, breaking before its force into wide, striated ripples, very much like the haze of heat which might appear over packed ground or sand in high summer. They melted away nearly at once again, but below, the dragons of the corps were all putting their heads up from their clearings to watch them coming on, and roaring out in answer glad greetings, and Temeraire banking took them down in a broad field, on the army's left flank, near about Plumstead.
"Lawrence," Temeraire said as they were settling, "pray will you tell the generals that I am very happy to come and speak to them, but they will need to clear some room at their tent if it is that large one in the middle of camp, and also they had better do something about the horses."
"I must prepare you. They will certainly not be in the least happy to have you come," Lawrence said, "nor take any act towards easing that end."
"Then," Temeraire said, "we will all go away again, and they may fight Napoleon without us. They have asked us to come, and they need our help. They may not treat us like slaves. And we will manage to feed ourselves, I dare say, somehow or other, even if they do not like to keep giving us cows."
Lawrence hesitated. He wished to voice some protest and speak of duty, but justice silenced him. It was surely in no wise Temeraire's duty, nor the duty of any of those dragons who had never been asked for an oath, nor received any recompense for service. His own duty he saw less clear. If he were ordered to remain, to serve, whether in the field or a sentence of death, there could be no alternative. But he feared the duty demanded of him would be rather to persuade Temeraire to stay, against the dragon's own interests, if necessary. He was brought to the same tent again, now much altered. The map tables occupied the lion's share of the floor, unfolded wide and littered with markers and figures. A steady, low arguing was going on in a back chamber which had been added on. Through a fresh-cut flap, querulous voices and frightened, and only a few with any note of decision. Lawrence could hear Jane's voice rising clear and ringing above them all. He was kept standing silently, trying not to overhear. A group of young, lean, unsmiling officers were working over the tables,
They looked at Lawrence with cold disdain, and then paid him no attention. At length a colonel came out and said to Lawrence icily,
"I am to tell you that you will be pardoned if you can make the dragons fight."
That the remark gave him no pleasure was evident.
"Damned disgrace,"
one of the young men in the corner muttered without looking up.
"Bring me 60 dragons the hour before a battle, and I will pardon your treason and murder too,"
Wellesley said, coming out of the back room.
"I don't know what sort of genius of disaster you are, Lawrence, but if you can be aimed at Bonaparte instead of us, you are worth not hanging. Can you make the beasts obey?"
"Sir," Lawrence said, "I have brought you no dragons.
You would better say the dragons brought me. They do not obey me, but Temeraire." "And the creature obeys you. That is good enough for me," Wellesley said. "I am not in a mood to have my time wasted with legalities. Do your damned duty, or I will have you hanged before I go and get myself shot on the field."
He snatched a paper from the table and scribbled upon it a few hurried lines, which could have been interpreted in nearly any fashion one chose, and thrust them out. Lawrence looked at the paper, life, liberty, duty, all in one, and was nearly grateful to Wellesley for the bribery and threats, distasteful in themselves, which could only make the command easier to refuse.
"You will forgive me, sir," he said. "I cannot make you the promise you wish. I have not the power to make it good. If you wish to speak with the leader of the dragon militia, that is, Temeraire himself, and he will not obey, nor the beasts with him, if they are not consulted."
"For the love of God and Bonaparte on our doorstep," Wellesley said. "Do you imagine we have time to go jumping a mile across camp to coddle dragons now, and not just men?"
"He needs no coddling, sir," Lawrence said. "Beyond what information you would consider appropriate for any commander of a substantial militia arrived late and without any prior knowledge of your plan of attack. He is more than willing to come to you if there were space cleared for him, and the horses secured against their natural instinct of flight." Wellesley snorted.
"Plan of attack? He can't know any less about it than any man alive does. Rowley," he said, turning abruptly to one of the young men at the side of the tent, who jerked to attention. "Go tie up the horses and clear enough room for him to land. How much does he need?"
He waited for no answer, but went back into the general staff meeting.
"Temeraire will require some 150 feet square to come down," Lawrence said to Rowley, going outside with him.
"What is he, clumsy as a cow?"
the young man said sourly, and shouting gave orders for several tents to be moved and an entire picket line of horses.
"I won't answer for your neck if he eats the general's favourite horse," he added.
Lawrence did not bother to answer these remarks, but went as quickly as he could back to the clearings and halted. Word had travelled at speed, and a handful of his crew had come to the camp, evidently having slipped away from their other assignments.
"Sir,"
Fellows said, glancing up from his work, and Blythe beside him with a small forge. Gangly young Alan stood up, flushing, 2 inches taller at a glance than he had been, and touched his hat, and with them Emily Rowland.
"Gentlemen,"
Lawrence said, torn between gratitude and dismay, for they were working not on harness and armour, but on Temeraire's platinum breastplate, and Emily had brought Temeraire's jewelled talon sheaths. These, having been given him in China, were remarkably beautiful, and remarkably gaudy, gold and silver engraved with elaborate oriental designs, and studded with small chips of gemstones. His breastplate, with its great pearl and sapphires, further advanced the service of vanity, with his old, smaller string of gold and pearls suspended from its chain not at all complimentary. Besides this, Temeraire had arranged to have himself scrubbed until he gleamed, and even, Lawrence was sorry to see, his handful of scars painted over with a pot of the sort of glossy black used upon doors and iron railings. It was most notable upon his chest, where a barbed French ball had taken him in the flesh during an engagement at sea. The wound had been ugly, and though healed clean, had left a puckered knot of scales. When Lawrence came in, Temeraire was engaged in examining himself critically as best he could, in a large dressing-room mirror good enough only to show perhaps 5 feet of him at a time, and considering whether to add a spangled net of chains to be draped over his ruff.
"His Kierke offered me it," he said, "and while, of course, ordinarily I would not borrow anyone else's things and pretend that they were mine, I am only thinking that, as we have not had time to make medals yet, it might stand in for them."
"Pray let me advise you against it,"
Lawrence said, sadly, imagining the general's reaction.
"Borrowed finery cannot be to anyone's taste, and if it should be lost or damaged, you would be indebted."
"Oh," Temeraire said, "that is very true. I suppose I had better not."
and he sighed wistfully.
"Very well, Roland. Take it off."
And he lowered his head reluctantly. It did not matter much, however, in the end. Temeraire descended to a great spreading silence, even the horses' frightened cries dying away to overwhelmed stillness. Rowley, still waiting outside, was pale beneath his dark, narrow moustache, as Temeraire neatly fitted himself into what was indeed a very cramped space for him, having to coil up his tail as he landed.
"Well, is it here?"
Wellesley said, coming out, and pausing, looked up and up and up, and said nothing more. A few pieces of jewellery were perhaps not much to notice, Lawrence realised, when one had never seen the whole dragon before. And as an army officer, Wellesley had likely never been close to a beast over courier weight. A seaman might at least have served on a transport.
"I am Colonel Temeraire, at your service," Temeraire said, peering down interestedly.
"You are you?"
Wellesley said after another moment, recovering his voice.
"You'll do to stop a few mouths, anyway. Rowley, go tell those fellows in there to come out, so we can meet with our new colonel."
A man came hurriedly out of the tent, no military officer, but a gentleman in a neat, sober suit of dark brown.
"General, if you will forgive me, the Ministry feels there is some danger of precedent. If I might have a word—"
He had not properly, fully noticed Temeraire yet. While he talked, his eyes flicked a few times to the side and up, caught glimpses of black scales, the smooth horn of the talons, impressions which over the course of his sentence accumulated until at last he raised his head to look properly and fell silent.
"No, you mightn't,"
Wellesley said with satisfaction, watching him choke, and pressed him unresistingly into a folding chair.
"Have a seat, Giles. Rowley, go on and tell the rest of them to come out here."
"I beg your pardon," Temeraire said to the poor man, who trembled violently as the dragon's head lowered near.
"But if you are part of the Ministry, I should like a word myself. We would like to vote, please, and also to be paid."
The professional soldiers were not quite so easily quelled, and Jane dispelled a great deal of the effect by coming out and saying to Temeraire,
"Did you deck yourself out for Christmas? This is a war, not a Vauxhall burlesque."
"I have put on my nicest things to be respectful," Temeraire said, injured.
"To show away, you mean?" Jane said.
And as this mode of conversation did not result in her being eaten or squashed, the others grew more bold. More bold than Wellesley at least would have liked. He had very evidently hit on the notion of stifling dissent with his own proposals through an intimidation by proxy, more than he had any real interest in consulting Temeraire's opinion. What threat they faced was not any longer the subject of disagreement. Scouts and word along the road had brought enough plain intelligence for that. The Fleur de Nuit would come, two formations worth of them, likely near the middle of the night, and would bombard them steadily until morning, when the massed French lines would fall upon them and try to drive them from their position. This position was indeed an enviable one. The generals had retreated from the coast very particularly to reserve for themselves the luxury of choosing the next battlefield. That Napoleon would seek to occupy London had never been in doubt. He had occupied Vienna, though that city lacked strategic value, and marched through Berlin only for the moral value of these victories, the personal and not the military satisfaction of standing in his enemy's palaces and feeling them his own. And London had a great many banks, gold and silver to fuel his invasion, and the chance to split the country south from north, with the Thames as a useful vein bringing him lifeblood from the coast. So the British army had arranged itself on the southern bank between Woolwich and Oxley's Wood, overlooking the great Dover Road to London, barricades having been established across what alternate roads might have served the French. If these impediments were not as advanced as one would have liked, Napoleon having moved too quickly, still they would have markedly delayed the progress of any great mass of men, and given the British time to fall upon them from behind. And they were well placed if Napoleon tried to come at the city down the river. But Napoleon did not mean to scorn the gauntlet which had been thrown down. He was coming to them along the main road. In the present encampment, the British had the advantage of higher ground, with several stout farmhouses and a few old stone walls and fences for barricades and fortifications, which would make them all the harder to dislodge.
"We will hold here,"
Sir Hugh Dalrymple said. He had the command, an older officer with a stout neck and fair hair creeping back from his temples.
It would be a folly to yield so advantageous a position.
And if we are forced to yield it, Wellesley said dryly. There was marshy ground on their western flank, sodden with snow, but no one would discuss this difficulty.
He has moved quicker than we had expected, but we must not let this throw us into disarray,
General Dalrymple continued.
That is how the Prussians ran into trouble, letting him cast them into confusion, changing their minds and their ground 10 times a day.
Sir, I beg your pardon, Lawrence said, unable to restrain himself. That a lack of decision plagued the Prussian army I cannot deny, but they were outfought, sir, on open ground.
With this trick of horse blinders you have gone on about in your report, Dalrymple said, you may set your mind at ease,
he added in ironic tones, which said without a word how little he trusted Lawrence's anxiety.
We have not discounted what of your intelligence could be confirmed. Our horses have their own damned hoods now, and if Bonaparte thinks he will stampede us with a few dragon charges, he will soon learn otherwise.
And this time, Bonaparte has let his thirst for speed outpace his sense, another general said.
All the scouts agree, even the beasts,
he added coldly in Jane's direction before she had said a word,
that he has not brought up all his army yet. He has some 30,000 men, not 50, and we are not far short of him even without our levies and reinforcements.
You will be a damn sight shorter by morning, she answered, if you mean to lie here and be bombarded, and my scouts have made 30,000, but that does not mean there are not more to come.
"You have caterwauled without a stop how we must have these 60 more dragons," another officer, a colonel, said belligerently, "and swallow treason, and unhandled beasts to have them, and now you talk as though we have nothing to do but sit and bear it while the French drop round shot on our heads. If they are of no use here, they are of no use at all."
"We have seen a great many of the French along our way from Wales,"
Temeraire said, putting in his own oar,
"and of course we can stop the Fleur de Nuit if we can only see them, but at night that is difficult."
"Difficult? So is winning battles difficult,"
General Dalrymple said, scowling and not looking up. He beckoned to his aide and thrust out a map to Lawrence.
"You will take the beasts here 1 mile out past camp," he said, "and hold the Fleur de Nuit there until morning."
"That is very silly. The Fleur de Nuit will go right around us if we are 1 mile out,"
Temeraire said.
"A couple of rounds against Lefebvre's rear guard, and now you try to tell us our business,"
Dalrymple said to Lawrence.
"My God, I have half a mind to—" "You will obey orders, damn you. You will do as you are told and be grateful for the chance."
"If I had done as I was told," Temeraire said, "you should have 60 less dragons, and Lefebvre would have a good deal more food, and tomorrow Napoleon would likely beat all of you for good, so that is a very stupid thing to say. Why ever ought I do as I am told?"
"If you do not, we will hang—"
the belligerent officer began, and Jane said, "Maclean!" Too late, and Temeraire growled deep in his throat and lowered his head with his ruff up sharp.